I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Immigration is sure to be one of the key issues in the upcoming presidential race. In fact, it already is as the election begins to take shape. President Obama took executive action on reform recently, complaining that Congress was unable to agree on compromise legislation. One of the complaints about both legal and illegal immigration is that it steals jobs from Americans. And after the economic collapse and uneven recovery from the recession, that argument has been persuasive. Our guest Adam Davidson wrote in the Sunday New York Times Magazine, it's not entirely true. We wanted to know more, and we asked him to explain. He's a columnist for the magazine, co-host of NPR's Planet Money. And Adam Davidson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
You know, I have to say, I read some of the letters in response to your article in the magazine yesterday, and I have to say, at least the readers of the New York Times are not buying it. They didn't seem to be persuaded by your arguments.
Well, people who comment are not representative of the overall audience. So, but I was struck. I mean, it was interesting. On Twitter, I felt like there was a hugely overwhelmingly positive response, and then on the comments section, there was a overwhelmingly negative response. I'm sure there's some argument for that, but neither group, of course, is typical. We do know from opinion polls that the vast majority of Americans do support amnesty for undocumented workers in America. And, you know, the New York Times is officially not a liberal paper, but we do know that our audience tends towards the liberal side, and the numbers are overwhelmingly in favor among self-identified liberals or Democrats, although a majority of Republicans and a majority of self-identified Tea Party Republicans support some form of amnesty for undocumented workers here. But that doesn't mean, you know, what I was talking about in this column was probably a more radical position than I would guess most Americans would be comfortable with.
And we'll get to that radical position, but clearly the myth endures. I mean, it's one of the reasons that you wanted to write this piece was to take a hard look at this myth.
Yeah. So to explain it, I think that there's a very common perception that immigrants steal jobs. And I imagine that it feels very logical. You see some immigrant doing a job, whatever it might be, and you think, well, if that immigrant weren't here, that job would still be done, and it would be done by someone native-born or someone who came here illegally or whatever. But I think that misunderstands a basic aspect of how labor works, of labor economics. We human beings are not just suppliers of labor. So the way I understand it, why people make this what economists call the lump of labor fallacy, is that people see that there's an increased supply of workers. They think of other things where the supply increases. I use the example of oranges, but you could use anything else. And they think, well, when the supply goes up, the price falls, meaning wages would fall, or more are unused. So those people are workers, they're coming here. And so either wages for everybody falls or there's just a lot more unemployed people. But people are not oranges, they're not iPhones, they're not lumps of steel. They're people who supply labor but also demand labor. They get wages and then they spend those wages. They rent homes or buy homes. They eat in restaurants. They get haircuts. They buy cell phones. They buy cars. And so what they do is they increase the supply of labor, but also the demand of labor. So the net position is unemployment should not be affected. There's no reason why this should hurt native-born workers.
I mean, that is all very rational, but I also wonder whether many Americans are still feeling a bit of a PTSD from the recession, the economic implosion, the slow economic recovery, which has been uneven. And also, when you look deep into some of these jobs numbers, you find out that there are numbers of people that have just literally given up on looking for a job altogether. So trying to sort of reconcile, I guess, post and pre-recession and to feel secure that there will be a job for yourself and also a job for your family members.
But this recession the recession is long over, but we're in a, you know, far too slow recovery and still, you know, far below where on a far below the peak employment that we had in 2007. But that should just, you know, to me, that's just further evidence that this is not an immigration story. You know, economists generally look at Federal Reserve policy, which is confusing and makes your head hurt, but that is what affects the overall employment picture, what the Fed does. And, you know, this recession and very slow recovery were the result of distortions in the financial sector, distortions in global capital markets, the flow of funds around the world that were probably the result of distortions in Federal Reserve policy. So nothing to do with immigrants. In fact, immigration has slowed, and you know, the net number of undocumented workers has gone down because people have been leaving America where there's fewer jobs and going back home. So it, of course, there's pain out there. And of course, someone laid off is really frustrated. And if they see somebody who's an immigrant who has a job they think they would like, I'm sure that would be maddening. I'm sure that would be very frustrating. But there's no actual evidence that you're laid off because of immigration. And in fact, the evidence is your life is probably better because of immigration.
But what if you're low income with few skills? Are you the more sort of likely victim of our immigration system?
So this is where there is this is where the debate is among economists. I would say that among economists, left, right, and center, there's effectively zero debate over high-skilled immigrants. And they define high skill as college degree or above. So I would say that it would be extremely hard to find a mainstream economist of any stripe who thinks that we shouldn't allow far more skilled immigrants in. So BAs, MDs for sure, engineers, et cetera. There is some debate over the impact on low-skilled Americans, meaning in this context, high school dropouts. And there is a real debate there. The data is not so clear as to erase that debate. But for groups, especially African American men, where unemployment rates are 50%, 60%, 70%, depending on the location, there is some debate that it costs them. Now, the largest recorded cost, so these are economists who are fairly skeptical of immigration and want to show a large impact, say it hurts their wages about 7%. Hmm. So that is not – that's a big deal. And if you're only making, you know, $15,000 a year, 7% would be painful. But we're not talking about explaining 50% unemployment or 70% unemployment through immigration. That's just not enough. The impact isn't big enough. Now, other economists say, no, there's no effect on wages, or there's only a 1 or 2% effect on wages. But there really is no evidence that the core challenge that the unskilled or the poor face today is an immigration challenge. There's the most coherent peer-reviewed arguments are still far more mild than the story that immigration skeptics tell.
It is true, though, that for the illegal or undocumented immigrants who do work in this country, they largely work in low-skilled jobs, though, don't they?
Yes. I mean, yeah, we have basically two immigration streams. We have undocumented, which, you know, disproportionately are low-skilled and severely low-skilled. I mean, very, very often undocumented workers from, you know, which in America means Mexico, Central America, maybe didn't attend high school at all. If they did attend high school, it probably was not, you know, there's severe education problems. So it's extremely low skilled. And that's another issue or another question, whether a high school dropout in America who drops out at 16 is probably several degrees more skilled than an immigrant who comes in who, you know, went to fourth grade, speaks no English, doesn't understand how America works, et cetera. So that's another argument for why they're not directly competing for jobs.
We've done a number of shows about immigration and had callers who say, that they, you know, would love to hire someone to work in their construction industry or to work in landscaping or even to pick produce, and they cannot find Native American workers willing to do this. Now, part of the argument is, well, if you pay people better, maybe you could get them in. But how do you look at that?
Well, I mean, that if you paid people better, maybe that activity would not be commercially viable. I mean, you know, you and I work in public radio.
If we do.
If they paid public radio people $500,000 a year, you know, more people would want to work in public radio, but public radio wouldn't survive very long. So, you know, the reason a lot of these jobs are paid so poorly is they're extremely low value added jobs. And so if you rate the choice set available is not, do I pay undocumented workers really low wages or do I pay an American really high wages and everything else remains the same? The choice set is, do I do this at all or do I not do this? And that's especially true in agriculture, I would say, and where, you know, very quickly you start hearing people talking about investing in apple picking machines or other what they would call capital substitutions for labor as soon as wages start rising. So, and I want to make clear, my argument is not that nobody is hurt. I'm sure millions of people in America have been hurt by immigration. I'm sure that there are people listening right now whose lives are worse because of immigration. That is not the, I'm not, my argument is not, and by the way, when I say my argument, I feel like I'm saying the basic standard economist argument. So if you are mad at me, you know, be mad at economists
the
as
people
well.
That you quote in your article.
Yeah. But the argument is, on balance, if you look at this policy overall, does it hurt or help America overall, native-born Americans, whichever group you want to look at? And I would say, on balance, it helps us. It doesn't hurt us. That does not mean 100% of Americans are helped and 0% are hurt.
And we're almost up in a break here, but it's a good example. If you look at Europe and they have many fewer immigrants, they have much bigger struggles with their economy because of their immigration policies, which are less generous than ours?
Yes. I mean, the key here – so if we were just looking at today, at 2015, I'd say the benefits are relatively modest, about 1%. So the argument is, on average, an American is about 1% richer because of our immigration policy. But when we look forward into the, you know, 2040s, 2050s, 2060s, there's really no way to have an America that is functioning without either the current immigration policy or preferably a far more generous one. That's because we are an aging population. We are facing what economists call the demographic time bomb. And without immigrants, like Japan and Europe are facing this problem, we're in a lot of trouble.
And I do want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Adam Davidson. He's a columnist for the Sunday New York Times Magazine, co-host of NPR's Planet Money. And we're talking about an article he had over the weekend debunking the myth of the job-stealing immigrant. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. Much more after the break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Adam Davidson. He's a columnist for the Sunday New York Times Magazine, had a piece in the magazine over the weekend saying that immigration is essentially good for the country and is a job creator. He's also co-host of NPR's Planet Money. You've had a little taste of what we've been talking about. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So, Adam, let's hear about your more generous immigration plan.
Well, I would actually start from the standpoint of open immigration. You know, what if we just simply didn't have restrictions on immigrants? And what would the world look like, at least as a thought experiment at first?
Interesting to contemplate.
And, you know, in this time of day, of course, we'd need some kind of security review, but I begin with the idea of just what would happen. And I think some people instantly think, well, wait, there's 7 billion people on Earth. Maybe they'd all come to America. But I don't find that a likely scenario. I do like to point out, by industrial country standards, America is an extremely underpopulated landmass. So even if you look at the most populated areas of the country where you and I live, New York, Philadelphia, Mid-Atlantic, the Northeast, New England, we could double or triple our population density and still be below Germany, Italy, Spain, France, you know, countries we think of as very comfortable countries to live in, not overcrowded countries. And then if we look at much of the, you know, Midwest or Northern Midwest, these are some of the least densely populated places on Earth. I mean, really, really sparsely populated. So there's not a fundamental land issue. And people say, well, wait a second, what about the environment? I would point out these human beings already exist. They're already on the Earth. And many of the people who would likely come to America are those who are likely to be part of the massive urbanization happening in the developing world. And that's an extremely damaging going from an agrarian country to an urban country, as is happening in China and India, parts of Latin America, Africa, Turkey. That is where you really degrade the environment. Adding additional people to an already developed country has less pain for the environment. So so I start from that standpoint. I personally can see zero reason to turn down any college educated or above person in the world who wants to come to America. I don't understand why we do that at all. But at a minimum, I would say, well, let's just be far more generous. Let's, instead of issuing 500,000 immigrant visas a year and maybe another 500,000 green cards, let's issue, you know, 2 million, 3 million, something like that. I think that we would then engage in a debate over lower skilled immigrants, and that would be a place where there, I think, in my view, there is more fact based argument to have. But that would be my perspective, a much more radically open border.
And what you seem to be saying is that the more people we have in this country, the more prosperous the country can be, the more jobs we can create, the better our economy.
Yes, I think that you know, there's several channels for this. So on balance, we're not you know, right now the estimates are we're about 1% richer the average American. That's not a huge impact. That's not massive. But the long-term story, if we want America to be a safe, thriving country in 2050, that's where you really get the huge bang for the buck. Letting in, I mean, and the math is very clear on skilled immigrants. You know, my bias would be also to allow lots of unskilled immigrants, but that's where the debate would be. But if we leave it just to skilled immigrants, that's where we really see the huge bang for the buck over, you know, I have a 3-year-old son. So when he's my age, he will be in a much, much better country if we allow a lot more immigrants in. And frankly, I hope this is intuitive. We did do this. We had fairly open borders. We brought in millions and millions of people, like many of our ancestors, including mine, from Russia, from Ireland, from Italy, from Germany, etc. And I hope it's intuitive to most people that America is much wealthier, much stronger, much more stable because of that immigration, not despite it.
Well, we've always seemed to have such an ambivalent feeling about immigration or even immigrants themselves. As you mentioned, you know, 100-some years ago, many immigrants coming from Eastern Europe, it's not like they were welcomed with open arms. I mean, we settle this, I think, as generations settle in. But there seems to be a kind of almost like a knee-jerk hostility to immigration, even though we are a country of immigrants.
Yes. And I don't really have much to say about the cultural aspect of this. I mean, I grew up in a very multicultural world in Greenwich Village. I love living in a city with lots and lots of different cultures, languages, restaurants, etc. But I can't give objective reasons why that's better. I prefer it. I understand some people don't prefer it. I don't know what to say about that. But economically, which is the area I like to think I have at least some knowledge, the argument to me is settled. This is not we're no longer debating it. It's fairly settled. Immigrants help the country economically. Whether you prefer to live, you know, in a country with fewer minorities or fewer immigrants, okay, that's a personal choice. I don't have much to say to that.
Let me pick up on something you said earlier about the baby boomers who are beginning to retire and assuming they live into their 80s or 90s or maybe even beyond. Is that where you think some of these more low-skilled workers can be put to work? There's going to be a great need for healthcare workers and assistants, healthcare assistants, people like that.
Yes, absolutely. Much of the job growth is the Department of Labor calculates over the next 10 to 20 years is in these lower skilled jobs, the healthcare being one of the predominant areas. And this brings up another issue that always comes up when you talk about immigration. You know, aren't all these low skilled immigrants taking welfare and food stamps, et cetera? And the data I've seen is pretty persuasive that on balance, immigrants are positive for government coffers. That's because many immigrants do pay into Social Security. Undocumented workers will have a fake Social Security number, pay into Social Security, but then never receive any payments. The problem is immigrants as a group tend to be positive for federal government taxes, but negative for state, local, and municipal taxes because, you know, food stamps, public schools, hospitals, et cetera, tend to be funded on the local level. And we don't have a good mechanism in this country for transferring gains at the federal level to losses at the local level. And, you know, that would certainly be something that would be great to solve along with any kind of comprehensive immigration reform so that the pain could be less acute. I mean, there certainly are places in southern Texas and, border counties that are really hurting because of immigrants. And it would be nice if the rest of the country that's benefiting could subsidize those losses.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Adam Davidson, and he's a columnist for the Sunday New York Times Magazine, also happens to be co-host of NPR's Planet Money. And we are talking about immigration, something that he wrote about over the weekend for the magazine in an article titled Debunking the Myth of the Job-Stealing Immigrant. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you think. Let me get George from, looks like Kensington, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I apologize if I get a little worked up. This is a subject I feel very passionately about.
That's good.
It seems to me that the way to solve our so-called immigration problem is to put all these immigrants, all these illegal immigrants, on the path to citizenship, because, you know, and get them invested in the country. Because it seems to me that they are not the problem. Our nation is built on immigration. That's what makes us who we are. The problem to me is the contractors and business owners that are taking advantage of them, that are paying them substandard wages. You know, in construction, so many of these guys, are paid a flat fee in cash for the day and treated, and then the construction contractors then show them as paying paying a private contractor. They don't have to show any record of that, nor do they have to pay any taxes on that. They don't have to, you know, so these people are not putting towards Social Security, and they're not getting anything back from it. If they get hurt on the job, they're not covered. And yet the prices are still, they're still charging the same. They're charging almost the same as union jobs.
Well, George,
just a little bit under in order to get the contract, and they're screwing these immigrants.
Well, you know, George, I'm looking at the computer screen here. You were a union iron worker for years, right?
So I had to get out of the for a long time, and then doing rebar and concrete work. And that is a very small field anymore because of all the jobs outside of the city are all going non-union, because the contractors charge a little bit less to get the bid and then pay these guys, instead of paying me $35 an hour plus benefits, they're paying these guys $150 a day cash and then wiping their hands of it.
Well, George, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me put that to you, Adam Davidson. And I guess the question that we haven't really addressed is what you do about about 11 million undocumented immigrants who are already here in this country.
Yeah, so I think George's point is right on. I mean, the part of the pain, if there is pain, again, this is debated, but if there is pain for lower skilled workers and others who compete with undocumented workers, so construction workers, et cetera. Part of that is because we do have this, you know, separate legal system, or, you know, an under the table black market legal system for undocumented workers who have fewer options, who are paid below mandated minimum wages, aren't paid overtime, often suffer from lost wages, et cetera. So, I mean, to me, obviously, I want more immigrants. So I'm certainly for a path to amnesty for those already here, you know, and I'd probably be on the aggressive side for that path to amnesty. So that's an easy argument for me to make. But it turns out most Americans, like 3-1, 2-1, are in favor of a path to amnesty for most Americans. And that would probably do a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit to help those who feel they've been displaced by immigrant labor.
Would it also help the state so that if you got people kind of above board, then they would be paying taxes and helping property taxes and things like that, paying for the public schools and, you know, whatever government services people need?
Right. Exactly. Yes, exactly. There's no pain from making people legally part of our country. It doesn't make any sense to me. Of course we want them to be.
George, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Adam, what if – I mean, this is not going to happen, clearly, but – if all the illegal immigrants were sent back home, what would the impact be on the economy? Has someone run that experiment?
I mean, it's so unimaginable and unrealistic. You know, I hate to say it, but I suppose there would be a short-term GDP increase because that'd be an awful lot of buses or trains or trucks or whatever mechanism, you know, moving 11 million people, finding 11 million people, processing them. You're talking about constructing detention centers. You're talking about I mean, it's awful to contemplate. But just imagine the infrastructure. My guess would be the year we did it, we'd have a short-term boost to GDP, and we'd have a lot of people put to work doing those jobs. But I would expect you would see countless bankruptcies in immigrant-heavy sectors like construction and meatpacking and agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. And I would expect you would see enormous and painful disruptions throughout the economy. I also think most Americans would not like it, and it would cause, you know, Democratic upset, not Democratic Party, but so it's unimaginable. But yes, my argument would be long term, it would be disastrous for the U.S.
Let me see what John from looks like Society Hill has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I have some experience working on farms, and I've got to tell you, you two keep referring to non-skilled labor. And it requires a skill. Most of our farm work requires a skill. The fact that we can hire people who have those skills for a little bit of money because they haven't had the opportunity to learn another job doesn't make it low-skilled. I mean, simple things like stacking hay or picking apples is really easy to mess things up. So these people actually bring a skill set to the country, something that's missing.
Well, fair enough, John. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And it is tricky, Adam, you know, talking about skilled and unskilled or low skilled when, as John says, you know, these are jobs that do require skills.
Yeah, and I should be careful about my language. I'm using kind of the technical language they use in the economic textbooks, which basically is differentiating high school dropouts from people with a BA. But he's absolutely right. I've spent time on farms, and I do have a BA, and I am useless and unskilled and would cost a farm a lot of money if they hired me. So he's absolutely right.
We have an email for someone who wants to remain anonymous, Adam. He says, Adam Davidson is so singing from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce hymnal, living out industries where immigrants are demonstrably replacing Americans, e.g. the IT sector, where unqualified U.S. STEM workers are compelled to train their H-1B replacement. And this is a little bit in the weeds, but as I said, I think there's just a strong resistance to what you are saying about immigrants.
Well, I would point out that we know from public opinion surveys that most Americans at least agree with my soft argument that a path to amnesty is slightly more generous. You know, probably fewer agree with my more radical views, although my more radical views are pretty mainstream among, you know, professional economists. I will point that out. This is the other one that comes up a lot, that we import a lot of computer scientists and engineers, and that they have made life untenable for Americans. It just this I know that there are examples, and people have told me that they personally have suffered, and I'm sure that is true in some cases. But if you look nationally, if you look, the data just isn't there. I mean, unemployment among engineers in America is, you know, below 2%. You know, basically, the data isn't there. It's a very emotional conversation for some people, and there are people who feel that they have lost a job because of immigrants. But if you look nationally, you look throughout the economy, the argument just doesn't hold up.
Well, we're almost out of time here. And you began your article talking about the Mariel boat lift when Cubans came to this country and were absorbed into the culture, the economy of Florida, Miami in particular. But I was also thinking about last summer when, you know, children were running from Central America with their parents, largely their mothers, again, looking for a better life. Which is sort of comparing, contrasting these two very dramatic and compelling stories of immigrants looking for a better life.
Yeah, and the Mariel boat lift was interesting because you would expect we had in 3 months in 1980 the working age population of Miami increasing by 45,000 people, 7% increase, and there is no discernible impact on wages or employment levels. That's pretty striking. That tells you that we have a very, at least in Miami in 1980, and these studies have been repeated many, many times since, although that still stands as sort of the great test of this, that we have the ability to absorb a shockingly large amount of workers in a very short amount of time. We're a big country. We're a dynamic country. We're going through a tough time right now, but big picture, we can handle this. We can handle it.
Well, we always like to end on a positive note. Adam Davidson, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a columnist for the Sunday New York Times Magazine, had a story over the weekend about immigration. He's also a co-host of NPR's Planet Money. We've been talking about immigration and jobs, and coming up, our second guest in this first hour of Radio Times will be talking about where the jobs are. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So how long does it take for you to get to work? A new report from the Brookings Institute found a shift of jobs to the suburbs in the country's large metropolitan areas. This has created a particular challenge for low-income workers who have to rely on public transportation. It also has implications for land use and suburban sprawl. Natalie Holmes is co-author of this report, and it's from the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings and joins us on Radio Times. Natalie, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the average distance between a worker and their job these days?
So in the Philadelphia region, the Philadelphia metro area, the typical commute distance is about 7.8 miles. In this case, though, what we looked at was not how commute distances have changed, but how many jobs you can get to, how many jobs are nearby within a typical commute. And what we saw in a nutshell was that people are living near fewer jobs than they used to.
In fact, it seems like what you found looking at these trends over the years is that there are more jobs being created in the suburbs.
That's true. So nationally, and this is a longer-term trend, we're seeing both populations and jobs become more suburban. And that raises some interesting questions and I think particular challenges as we also see poor populations moving to suburbs, making sure that they're able to get to jobs and have services and things that they need to succeed.
And what kind of jobs are we talking about?
So for this paper, we just looked at total private jobs, so where total private jobs are going within regions. In the future, we'll be able to parse that by wage level and by the educational requirements of those jobs, but for now, we just looked at total jobs.
And what you found, looking, I think, at the years 2000 to 2012, suburban jobs, mm-hmm. broadly speaking, and we're talking about metropolitan areas, increased 4% and jobs in cities down 2%. Do I have that right?
That's right. And that's a pattern that we also saw in the Philadelphia region. So overall, the metro area saw a decline of about 2% in private jobs between 2000 and 2012. but that wasn't spread evenly. So there was about no change in the suburbs, but an overall decline of about 7% in the city of Philadelphia proper.
So what problems does that create for someone trying to get to work?
So when people live closer to jobs, they're more likely to be employed, and the length of time they spend looking for more work, for work between jobs tends to be shorter. That's especially true for low-income workers whose job search areas can be smaller because they face more constraints in where they can afford to live and how far they can afford to commute.
And I'm thinking of, so many commuting patterns are from suburbs to cities. If you live in a metropolitan area, that's sort of where the arrows are pointed when it comes to public transportation. This is different.
It is, yeah. In some ways, I think Philadelphia actually doesn't fit the pattern that we saw through this larger pattern. So in Philadelphia, we actually saw a steeper decline in the number of jobs for people living in the city and entering suburbs, and actually some improvement for people living farther out, out in Chester County, for example. But it's also, I think, important to note that the places that we saw the biggest decline, so in Philadelphia, Camden and Wilmington, have many more near jobs nearby. So the declines were larger, but they still have many more jobs nearby. So someone who lives in or around Center City, for example, is near about 600,000 or 700,000 jobs.
Wow.
And again, to a point that you raised earlier, our data goes through the year 2012, so our numbers don't reflect the recent Comcast expansion back in the downtown area or recent North 3rd Street tech growth.
But I'm also thinking about, areas of a city like Philadelphia, other big cities where you've got areas where largely poor people live. And if they want to get to work, if there isn't a job sort of around the corner in the neighborhood, then you don't have a car, you got to figure out how to get there by public transportation. And that can take time and it can take a lot of effort to try to get to work.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that's one thing that we're hoping to get across with this work is just to say that, if we care about everyone in our regional economy doing well, it's important to consider what the local reality is. It's great that we're continuing to recover from the Great Recession, that jobs are coming back. But those large aggregate trends can mask disparities at the local level. And you're absolutely right. I was talking to some friends who know more about the region than I do this weekend, and it's great that we're trying to bring manufacturing back to Philadelphia and, welding to the Navy Yard. But, if the Broad Street line doesn't go all the way down, that's one question. Can people get to the places where jobs are growing? And of course, that leaves out this question of whether they're prepared academically, for example. But whether they're able to physically get to where the jobs are is a big concern.
And it's not unusual to hear stories of people that take, a train, a bus, maybe even walk. And taking several hours even getting to work.
Yeah, you've probably been hearing about James Robertson in the suburbs of Detroit. Is that what you're referencing?
I was actually thinking about him. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so that's an extreme example. But again, the concern, and this builds off of work that we've done for several years, my colleagues Elizabeth Kneebone and Alan Berube, looking at how poverty is growing in the suburbs. So, a question we get a lot is it better or worse to be poor in the suburbs than in the cities? And one concern is you move out to the suburbs in search of affordable housing. What happens if your car breaks down and you don't have jobs nearby? You're kind of out of luck because we know that, transit systems aren't as robust out in the suburbs. They're not as good as connecting suburbs to each other. So if you have people living in some outlying suburb and their job is in another suburb, it might be especially difficult for them to get to that job.
And I'm also thinking about childcare. The farther you get away from whoever's taking care of your child, the more potential problems there are.
Absolutely. That's something that a lot of our work focuses on, is just how, these additional challenges that people can face by being poor in the suburbs. It's not, again, going back to the point I made earlier that, it's really important to look at what's happening locally. In some places, so Westchester County, you have high poverty neighborhoods where access to jobs actually improved, where proximity to jobs improved, but that's not a given. We have those concerns that you expressed that it might be more difficult to find services, to find childcare, to find a job. You're really more constrained in terms of what important components of economic success are near you.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Natalie Holmes. She's co-author of a new report. It's from the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institute, and it's looking at essentially where the jobs are, and increasingly talking about private sector jobs. They are in the suburbs, and it raises some interesting questions about people getting to work and things like childcare, but also land use and suburban sprawl. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. As you mentioned, Natalie, numbers of low-income people and families have moved to the suburbs. I guess we sort of call these the inner ring suburbs between the sort of edges of cities and where the suburbs begin. Do they have unique needs when it comes to jobs?
You know, I can't speak to the Philadelphia region specifically, I'm sorry. But, you know, one thing that's really interesting to note, I think, is that between 2000 and 2013, the poor population in Philadelphia suburbs, again, mostly inner ring, grew by 50%. So now, in 2013, you see sort of this even split in the poor population between the city of Philadelphia mm-hmm. and the suburbs. You know, and I guess building off of this paper specifically, when you're in less dense areas, when you're in areas that don't have as robust of transit systems, yeah, it might be more difficult to get to jobs.
I'm thinking, too, about, I mean, we've been focusing largely on these metropolitan areas, which, frankly, is where most people live and it's where most of the mm-hmm. jobs are. But even thinking about, you know, rural parts, not just of Pennsylvania, but also other parts of the country where it's got to be even tougher than what we've been talking about.
Yeah, and we didn't focus on that in this report. We have the underlying data. That's one thing that was really cool. We built this huge data set to look at these issues and sort of these dynamics, but we didn't focus on that specifically.
Focus on private sector jobs, and for instance, here in Philadelphia, there are a lot of public sector jobs, you know, meds and eds and things like that. Mm-hmm. If we factor that in, does that create a different picture?
So, again, our data stop at the year 2012, and it is all private sector. And you're right, you know, eds, meds, and government are some of the largest sectors in Philadelphia, and those were slower growing in recent years. Our data don't reflect the Comcast expansion, mm-hmm. and I think we also miss some of the recent tech growth in Nerd Street, for example. That's something to consider. Again, in the future, you know, we hope to be able to parse this further by the wage level of jobs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to look at, okay, how many jobs do you have near you? How many good-paying jobs do you have near you? And then also we hope to look at, you know, the skill sets needed in order to access these jobs.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, you know, it's great that you have these tech jobs, these STEM jobs, you know, potentially growing, but those might not be accessible to people who have less than a bachelor's degree.
You've done your homework because you talked about Nerd Street, which, you know, which in Philadelphia we know exactly what you are talking about. So, so what do you want this report to do?
Yeah. So, what we hope is that this information can help make more effective and targeted decisions to make sure that metropolitan growth and development doesn't leave vulnerable residents and neighborhoods behind. You know, like I said, moving forward, we're going to continue to look at sort of deeper cuts of this data and to help make sort of more targeted insights. But generally, I think what we find is that labor markets are regional, economies are mm-hmm. regional, but looking at those aggregate regional numbers can mask disparities at the local level. And if we want our regions to have broadly shared growth and if we want everyone to do well, it's really important to consider those local realities, where people are living, where poverty is growing most quickly, and to help make sure that we're not leaving those folks behind.
Do you see this as a growing trend, that there will be more jobs created in the suburbs than in cities? And again, we're talking about private sector mm-hmm. jobs. I mean, do you think that's part of a growing national trend?
That's the longer running trend. And I know, you know, much more recently in the past couple of years, we hear about this resurgence of cities, and that's definitely a component. I don't have the numbers in front of me about the extent to which that's a reality. But again, I would just urge people to think about whether those jobs are accessible to people who maybe don't have as much education.
And I guess, I mean, is it a matter then of sort of rethinking how we do public transportation, for instance?
I'm not a transportation expert, but I think we need to be sensitive to, you know, where people are living who are trying to access certain kinds of jobs. So, you know, I mentioned, you know, potential growth in welding and Navy Yard, for example, you know, and making sure that people who potentially could be trained for and take those jobs are able to get to those jobs. My understanding is the Broad Street line ends at the stadiums. Is that right? So it doesn't even go all the way down to
not
the...
Not yet.
But that's one example. That's one thing to consider. And just to be sensitive to those local realities, you know, where your workforce is, where it needs to go. Proximity is just one piece of the puzzle. It's, you know, when I use the word access, you can think of that as meaning, you know, do you have the right skill set? Do you have the right kind of transportation to get to a job, et cetera? So it's just important to keep all of that in mind.
Are we also talking a sort of still a recovery from the recession of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago that we're still sort of recovering from that and maybe haven't even replaced or created the kinds of jobs needed to support people looking for work?
I think that's definitely the case. We, about halfway through this process, actually, of building the data set for this paper, a new year of data came out. So, you know, looking at 2011 versus 2012, we can see big recoveries just over that 1 year period. And, you know, as soon as we have the 2013 data, we'll continue to add that. But it's just, you know, it's a reality of data collection that there's that lag in what we have. But I think that we will see some more recovery as new years come out.
And that's certainly good to know and to think about. Also, this does raise questions for suburban land use, for things like taxation. I mean, it's not written in stone yet, but if we're seeing this kind of shift of jobs, raises those questions as well. How should we think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's something that my colleague Elizabeth Kneebone has written a lot about, actually, and we're going to continue to look at. So, you know, as we see this influx of low-income people into the suburbs, into smaller communities, many of these communities just aren't equipped to provide services, you know, and to help support these populations that may need additional services. At the same time, you know, you're seeing your tax revenue base shrink as lower-income people come in. And it's, you know, from that perspective, it's really important that these folks are able to get to jobs so they can help contribute to that. But yeah, no, this is all new, you know. I think it still remains to be seen what suburbs can do to help address these issues. You know, collaboration across jurisdictions will be really important. We've seen some cool examples of that around the country. I'm from Seattle, so the South King County suburbs immediately to the south of the city have done some pretty great work collaborating in terms of providing services across school districts, et cetera.
We've called that regionalism around here.
Yes, absolutely.
You looked at 96 metropolitan areas. Would you say there is an area that is doing a stellar job or a better job than other areas?
That's a great question. You know, I think that the story is different everywhere. Like I mentioned, I think Philadelphia is a little bit different in that we saw numbers decline more in the city than in the suburbs, and that's not the case nationally. You know, but there are just different challenges around the country. I hope that answers your question.
Well, the clock tells me we're out of time. Natalie Holmes, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Co-author of this report, it's from the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institute, looking at the shifting of jobs, private sector jobs, from the cities to the suburbs. And we began our conversation with Adam Davidson about his piece in the New York Times Magazine over the weekend about immigration. And he also is a co-host of NPR's Planet Money. That's it for the first hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can download a podcast of the program. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.